This is the I Can Do It Hour with your host, Diane Ray.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining me for today's show. I've got a really amazing guest that I'm very excited about, so I know there's going to be a really great conversation today. My guest is film director Tom Shadyac, and if his name is not really familiar, I'm sure you've seen some of the movies he's directed. They're big ones. Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, The Nutty Professor, Liar Liar, Bruce Almighty, just to name a few, as well as his latest, the documentary I Am. And last year, Tom wrote a really incredible book called Life's Operating Manual, and it just came out a few weeks ago in paper. Back. So I dug into it again and reread it, and I enjoyed it even better the second time around. I really like this book. The book offers a simple yet provocative question. Is it possible that life really does come with a set of guidelines? And Tom shares a series of essays and dialogues between the voices of truth and fear, and he gives us a lot to think about in the process. So welcome back to Hay House Radio, Tom. I'm really glad you could join me today.
Good. Thank you, Diane. Happy to be here.
This is going to be so fun. I really love this book. So I just wanted to find out a little update since the last time that we spoke to you when the book first came out. So what have you been doing? I mean, you've been traveling, you've been speaking, you've been busy, I'm sure.
Yeah. And it pains me to say another book is growing inside me. Because you know, I'm sure you know, they're it's like birthing. This one was like birthing a sumo wrestler. It came out, but there was quite a laboring process. But yeah, I'm continuing to teach and write, and we're actually talking about maybe doing a third in the Bruce Almighty series. We've done Bruce Almighty, Evan Almighty, and we're talking about doing one called Brucifer, where Bruce would, of course, meet the devil. Morgan has always wanted to play the devil, Morgan Freeman. So we're talking about that. So onward and upward.
Wow, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, exactly.
Morgan Freeman is the devil. I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Wow, so there's been a lot going on. Now, how has the message, now that the book's been out for a little while, how has the message been received? What do you feel people are taking away from it?
Well, I don't encounter that many people. It's not like a film where I screen a film like I am. I screen a film and I see 500 people immediately thereafter tell me whether they were inspired or moved or confused or disagree or agree. With a book, it's different. This is my first book. So, you know, I do get that email from time to time. A friend of mine is named Bob Goff, and he wrote a book called Love Does. He did the most courageous thing in the world, which maybe I'll do in the future. He put his email on the back of the book. So every day, all day, he has not only his email, but his phone number, his phone ringing and his email lighting up saying, hey, I really loved your book. I have a question. And he responds to all of them. I didn't do that. So I've been a little shielded from the reaction, but I do know that it has provoked some thought. It's shifted some people's perceptions, which is what I wanted to do. It is a very, you know, provocative book. It turns the paradigm upside down. And so far, those few responses that I've gotten, they're maybe in the dozens or the hundreds, but not in the thousands like I get with movies. They've been really encouraging.
Well, I really like the journey that you went on in this book. And I've heard this about albums. It's probably about books, too, where you have your whole life to do the first one. You know, and you can kind of tell in this book that these were questions that you've kind of wrestled with over, you know, a long period of time, coming to conclusions. You did a lot of reading, you know, a lot of research into this. So, I mean, I wonder what your next book will be if it was your whole life up to this one.
That was really well said, by the way. I've never heard it expressed that way. 'Cause often those first albums are so beautiful and so rich and so deep, and you're right, they've been forming for so long. And this book has also been forming for a long time, as you said. It wasn't like I hit my head, if people saw I Am, I got a concussion and I nearly died, and then I made the film I Am, and everyone thinks that was, I saw the light. And I say, no, I did not just see the light, I saw a doctor. Hitting my head forced me to make I Am, facing my own death, you know, put me in my courage, but I'd been changing my life for years and years and years, always wanting to know what was true. That's what you see in Life's Operating Manual. I'd noticed these patterns that life actually tells you the conditions that create more life. It's right in front of us. It's, if you want to know what what the operating manual for life, the instructions are, look at life. And I had noticed this and become aware and awake to this over the course of many years and reading many things and experiencing many things. And the next book is actually even more hopeful. Life's operating manual is very hopeful because I believe that the soul is eternally optimistic. The soul, Emerson said, the soul always knows an optimism, never a pessimism. And I agree with that. And the next book is even more powerful. And I may make a sequel to I Am called I Am We Are.
I like that.
Yeah. It really dives into the idea that everything is exactly as it should be. And that this God, this force that we call the divine controller, organizer of the universe, knows what he, she is doing. And that we're on this arc, this moral arc of the universe, and we are moving towards love and justice and more awareness and more awakening. And I believe it's inevitable because I believe in this power that we call God, and it's in the job title. She knows what they're doing.
Well, you're right in that there does seem to be kind of an awakening going on. You know, people are kind of shifting, and you see little ideas or one person with an idea grow to be a big thing. You know, one person had the idea for the movie Blackfish, and now everybody knows what's going on with whales and in captivity, just for an example. You know, so people can start with just one small idea and make big changes.
Yeah. And what I don't think we realize is that shadow, the fact that the shadow exists, that maybe we have been abusing, say in this case, whales, in captivity for our entertainment. That shadow exists for a reason, to push us more towards the light. It's like the body gets healthier, not only when muscles tear, but when we introduce vaccines, for example, you introduce the poison into the body sees it, recognizes it, and says, uh-uh, we've got to get stronger now and create the climate so that this cannot grow. And I think that's why shadow happens with us. We have these poisons, these toxins introduced. We have one now, violence in schools and at the workplace is just an abhorrent idea. We all know that that's not how we can move forward as a species. And as painful as it is, I think we're growing through it. We're growing and moving more toward love. And I think that it's inevitable because I do think that the basic law of life is that love is more powerful than hate. And because of that, we're always moving on that moral arc. We're always moving upwards towards God, love, light, and at the same time telling an incredible story.
But it's so interesting, isn't it, when you talk about the shadow, where I sometimes see it as kind of a balance, like a big scale, where can you really have one without the other? Will good exist without evil, love without hate? You know, for every horrible person who throws a puppy out the window of a car, there's someone who will come along and pick that dog up and love it and save it. I mean, do you think that balance is always going to be, you know, fighting against each other, or love will prevail?
Oh, I think they're necessary. You just articulated what I believe is the bottom line existence of this plane where we are at, the space-time model, not the soul, not eternity, not home, if you will, which the previous show was talking about, but in the space-time model, it's all about opposites. Things only exist because they have an opposite, right? The best meal you've ever had is because you were hungry, you were starving. When you walk into a warm house, it feels so amazing because you've just been walking through the snow or in the cold or in the wind or the rain. Life exists in the belly of that paradox, that it takes the opposite, the shadow, for the light to shine. Right, they're necessary. But here's the coolest thing, is that because the light is stronger than the dark, we're always moving toward that light. If hate was more powerful than love, we'd have a Hitler rise up, and then more people would say, how can we do that again? That was awesome. That doesn't happen. When that person throws a puppy out the window, I would argue that not only does one person then be more kind to a puppy, there are hundreds and hundreds of people that would see and act like that and say, never again, I've got to get to work at my local animal shelter, maybe adopt or do something to be more humane to all of life. And because God, the great organizing intelligence, designed it this way, this life can go on. Otherwise, it would have imploded so long ago. But it doesn't work like that. It works because love is more powerful than hate. And what happens, I think, in our society and our perspectives and why we get negative, if you will, is because we focus on the shadow. The shadow is the exception to the human story. It is not the human story. And because we focus on that, we think, oh, we're doomed. But we don't see that that one act of hate has given birth to countless acts of love and kindness. They don't get reported.
Right, and that's true. And I was going to say the media certainly doesn't report on the good stuff. I mean, they do sometimes, but generally the better story is, you know.
They slip it in at the end for 1 minute, right?
But what bleeds leads.
There is a very good story going on. And it's this move. If you look now, you can see it. The homosexual community is gaining their equal status because it's beautiful and more powerful. And the love that they have is more powerful than the box that we put them in, than the definitions that we had and the limitations that we had. It happened to the African-American community. It's happening still to women gaining equality. These powerful ideas are true. They rise up and they take hold and they always win. It's like Gandhi said, love always wins. Hate can exist for a time. A tyrant can exist for a time, but they always fall. Think about it. Always.
Right. Although, unfortunately, a lot of times there will be another tyrant, like Caesar.
Yeah, of course, there will be other tyrants, but the tendency towards tyranny diminishes. If you look at our history, I know it doesn't seem that way now, but even the math on it, there are more people, and when you do the math on it, less wars, there's actually less violence in the world. It's just that we're aware now of the global state, but we are moving. I'm quite sure of it. I've got great, not just faith in this idea, but a true, found intuitive understanding that this is how God designed everything.
Well, what's so interesting in the book, and you say how God designed everything, is that when we look at other cultures and we look at animals and we look at nature, you know, what we were taught about survival of the fittest and all that is not true, that all these animal communities, the only way they survive is cooperation, not taking over and, you know, killing the next herd of deer in the field over, you know. So we can really look towards nature to see how that works. And then when you look at what we're doing, you know, there's this whole uprising in the Middle East and people are killing each other and genocide and all these horrible things that we read about. But when you boil it down, that's not our true nature, right? You're saying our true nature is really love and cooperation, just how everything else in nature works. But what is that really doing to us as people, as an organism, if we're going against what our true nature is? I guess we can see what's happening, right?
You can see, and it's why you asked the question. You see, your very nature feels that that is not how we can thrive, how we can go on and exist, how life can continue. You know that by this very question, and people know that. That's why they watch the news and they say, and they hang their head a bit and they say, oh, I'm so sad that the Middle East is exploding. But let's take a call from the Middle East 100 years from now, 200 years from now, maybe even less, God willing, less, and we'll see that these were growing pains, that they were working things out, that tribes with different points of view, faiths with different points of view, just like the Christian faith. We were very insecure when the Christian faith began, and, you know, we went out and killed people who didn't believe in the Christian faith. Well, some of the younger faiths are still in maybe what might be called a more fearful phase, but let's look at the long arc of this. It's not going to last. It can't. It's not how we can move forward.
And right. It's not sustainable.
It's impossible, and and we know this, but we get caught again in the illusion that, oh my gosh, we're just bad. You know, the idea of survival of the fittest was attributed to Darwin. Darwin didn't even come up with that phrase. He said it twice in The Descent of Man. It was a gentleman named Herbert Spencer. Darwin said the word love 95 times, and the reason that we lock into that is we don't see things as they are. We see them as we are, and currently we're fearful. We're overly competitive. We're still in that growing phase. I don't think we're bad. We're experimenting. We're still fearful, and we're seeing that it's not working. But love, Darwin knew, sympathy is mankind's greatest trait, is what Darwin said when he looked at these species that were thriving. You know, if you look at an ant colony, ants are one of the only species that thrives as well as we have as people. And the reason people have thrived, as Darwin pointed out, was because we could band together. We could do things together. There's no way we can, you know, survive in what you might call the wild if we couldn't come together and create. Ants are the same way. They come together, these tiny little things that just about anything could crush or eat, could be dinner, but they come together, they band together, they cooperate, and they thrive. So, you know, there's definitely competition in nature. This is not a pie-in-the-sky, dreamy sort of woo-woo idea about life. It's very practical. There is competition in nature, but competition in nature is always limited. And things that act as cancers always die off. What does a cancer do? It eats the body because it just doesn't know anything but growth. And so it grows, whether that's a kudzu vine or a cancer in the body. The end of that is always death, because we know what makes nature thrive is diversity. And when you destroy diversity, you destroy not only the home but the food source for you in the future.
Well, I like the study that you cite in the book showing how new that we really are.
Yeah.
As a society, you know, as creatures, I guess, on this planet, when you look at it as a whole, you know, mankind really is new. So what you're saying is we're still figuring this out, I guess.
Yeah, on the evolutionary scale, it's like we are about a second, you know, on a 24-hour clock. You know, we're some 100 to 200,000 years old. And if you look in the evolutionary scale, 4 billion years of life on this planet, 13.2 billion years since what we theorize as the Big Bang, we are just beginning. We're just beginning, and we're experiencing growth pains, and it's very understandable. You know, I look at everything through the lens of story because I've been a movie director, and when you look at great stories, characters always start out flawed, and then they learn as they go. They learn through trial and darkness and shadow. And that's what we are. If you look at this as a long-term movie, if you will, and the story that I think God is telling is incredible, we as a species are learning more and more, and we are evolving. We are not the same species that we were that 100 to 200,000 years ago. We have grown. You know, we no longer have public executions, you know, 99.99% of us. We don't disembowel anymore. There's, you know, the public executions are gone. We don't enslave legally, although there's still slavery in the world. It is absolutely dying off. It certainly has died off legally. It's a clandestine activity now. So we're moving, and it's this beautiful story arc. And I believe that this is how the divine experiences itself. You know, that the divine was an energy, and for energy, you know, to feel, you need to take form. And so we are the form that feels and acts out this incredible story, and it oftentimes very painful, but there's always beauty that comes out of that pain.
So we're on this big journey. The story is continuing, you know, growing and changing. But it seems like we're forgetting what's been known all along. I mean, you even say in the book, you know, none of this is new, really.
Yeah.
You know, what you're sharing, I mean, you're putting it in a really great way, easy to understand way, and kind of like shaking people up a little bit, like, look, kind of remember, you know, this is what we're supposed to be, not what we're doing, which is going against our very nature. And is it, like you talk about in the book, our beliefs, you know, we're conditioned to believe certain things, and we kind of go through life with what people are telling us to do. And is that fear holding us in those beliefs?
Yeah. You said earlier that it's always been, and let me start there. The laws of life have always been written into life. Again, in this paradigm, in the space-time paradigm, goodness knows what, you know, what how expansive it gets at the soul level, the eternal level. But in this paradigm, the laws of life have always been there. And Native cultures, they woke up to many of those laws of life because they were so steeped in life. They depended on nature for survival. They knew their connection with some force that put them there. They had various names for it, but they did believe in something greater, a higher power, if you will. And it was all about connection. And so these are the things we've forgotten because we've removed ourselves from nature. We said we can conquer nature. We have this idea that we can control nature, and we're finding out that we can't. We can work with nature, within the laws of nature. And these are the things that we've forgotten. And yes, it is our fear. To get back to that question, it is our fear. And guess what it's a fear of? It's a fear
change.
Of, what's that?
Change?
Death.
Fear of death, okay.
Change, of course, is just a manifestation of a kind of death, whether it's a change of relationship, a change of occupation, that is a death. But we're actually afraid of this thing we call death, because that's the great illusion, that we think death is real. That's why the mystic says, why all this talk about death? Too bad it's not real. The other mystics say, you know, if I'd have known how amazing it was, I wouldn't have waited so long. You know, death is, I believe, the freeing of this of the spirit from the space-time model. Where it goes, I'm not even going to venture to guess, but my belief and my intuition tells me it returns to whence it came, source, oneness, unity. It's when you lose yourself, you know, in the, say, even in an orgasmic state, you scream, oh, God, because you've lost all sense of ego. Suddenly you're caught up in that space, I believe. We get glimpses of it here. And it's fear. It's just fear. And when you look at fear, which is what I try to do in the book, I have a dialogue between fear and truth. When you look at fear, it diminishes, because fear is ultimately it's the ultimate illusion. Because beneath all of this flesh and this time and this space is this thing called the soul. It's why Julian of Norwich says, all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. It all is well. At the soul level, we're just working this play out, if you will, and we get so caught up in the play, we forget that it is part of the illusion.
Right. That's so interesting you said that, because I agree with you on that. I think people, well, especially in the West, I think maybe some Eastern philosophies are not quite as fearful of death as we are, and why we go to such great lengths to try to prevent it at all cost, even when that's the inevitable ending. You know, we're afraid of that. That's true. And I agree with you as well with, I think our souls, you know, we're kind of in these meat suits, you know, for whatever time that we are. But what we are is really eternal, our very essence. Like that, I don't think nature is that frivolous where that energy of whatever you and I are is just going to go away.
Right.
Right?
Agree. And that's why Life's Operating Manual starts with that question. In order to understand the operating manual for life, the ultimate question that needs to be answered is, who are you?
And it's a big question.
It's a big question, but I believe it also has a very, very simple, profound, powerful answer that changes everything. And when you realize that you're part of it, with a capital I, the great it, and that is inalterable. It doesn't matter if the book sells this much or if this many listeners come to the radio show, you're already it. That's why Thomas Merton said, I'm finally coming to the realization my greatest ambition is to be what I already am. And we already are this, and what we're learning, and I believe we're getting there, but what we're learning is to accept that as the basis to spring forward in creativity. And right now, we are not standing on that firm ground. We say, who are you going to be? Who are you going to be when you grow up, right? That's the emphasis. Who are you going to be? Not waking young people up and older alike to who they already are.
Right. That's such a great point. And even when you go back and read, like, you know, the Tao does nothing but leaves nothing undone, that we already are
right.
Good enough. But generally, we're filled with such self-loathing that we don't see that, you know. We have to be more. We have to lose more weight. We have to have more. And that's just such a pervasive message in our culture, don't you think?
Yeah, and I used to think that that was bad, but I don't. I don't see that anymore. I see that as a great character in a movie. That as soon as you say, you know what, I think I'm going to do. I don't think I want to be a doctor or a lawyer if that's not my calling. I think I want to be an artist. And the person comes up to you and says, "You can't be an artist. Nobody makes money as an artist. There's no directors that make money." So those things are necessary, because that allows each of us, as that lead character in our own story, to stand up and say, you know what, I hear you, I respect you, but I'm going on this journey anyway. I'm taking this leap anyway. And we get to then become, that's what character is. We develop character through going through these trials. So I think, I don't even see the trials as, quote, bad. I see them as necessary. And I see even the way we're evolving as necessary. It's creating a society that is going to be rich in character.
I'm talking with Tom Shadyac today about his book, Life's Operating Manual, just recently out in paperback with the Fear and Truth Dialogues. A New York Times bestseller. Congratulations.
Yes. I was very excited about that.
That's really great.
It's nice, yes.
And if you feel like answering some questions, we can open up the phones and get some people calling and joining in the dialogue.
Absolutely.
Which is always fun.
Absolutely.
So I'll throw out the numbers, 866-254-1579. That's toll-free in the U.S. or Canada. And outside the U.S., dial the U.S. country code, then 760-918-4300. And we'll give away a few copies of Tom's book as well, because I think that you all, if you haven't read it yet, you're definitely going to enjoy it, because it'll cause some great conversations around the household here. So, Tom, also in the book, I mentioned you dip a little bit into some quantum theory and some quantum mechanics. And I think that's so fascinating that there's this magic going on all around us, things moving around that people cannot explain how it works, that we are really connected, even though we've heard that for centuries. We are one, and we're like, yeah, right. No, we're not. You know, but there are scientists, there's people that are showing that there's really proof that that's true. And when you first started reading about that, didn't it just kind of like blow your mind? And
yeah, it's great.
Like, wow, this is crazy.
It blows your mind and drops you right into your heart. And somehow you're like, wow, that is so cool, because that's how I feel, but I didn't know that it existed in science, that it was something that we could point to, like we can point to an experiment and see. Now I think it's time. Like, I do believe in divine timing. We are, now that we're all one, we can talk to each other through this thing called the web, the internet. We're discovering the web in the micro particles of life, that everything is connected through this web. You know, space is not empty. We had this idea that space, literally, it means there's space, there's nothing there. No, there's this thing called the field. Lynn McTaggart talks about it very articulately. And Einstein said the field is the only reality. So when a mother has an intuition about a child who may have fallen and sprained their ankle at school, it may be that she's tapping into the field, instantaneously feeling or receiving a piece of information, an intuition. It's all now showing up in science in some really what we would call crazy, out-of-the-box, out-of-the-paradigm experiments. When does your dog know you're coming home with Rupert Sheldrake? You know, your dog knows you're coming home when the keys hit the door, when the car hits the driveway. No, when you make the decision to come home, the dog moves to the door. That doesn't make sense, not in this paradigm. But if you look at the quantum level, the connection of things, that the field is there, that it's not empty, that space is not empty, that everything is unified, God is one. Of course, if we do Brucifer, you know, that story about the devil, if you will, the dark energy, what does the dark energy do? It divides. Diaboline means to break apart. What does God do? It unite. God, the God force is a unifying force. So that unity is now found in science, and it's really cool. The experiments that they're doing, the discoveries that they're coming up with and finding, they're just starting, but it's very, very encouraging.
And these moments are around us all the time if we just kind of open our eyes and wake up to it. I had a quantum moment recently, I'll tell you really quickly. So I was at Chipotle here around the corner, and I'm sitting there by myself, just looking out onto the road. And I had a thought in my head, just randomly. I said, I bet someone's going to sit here at this table with me. And there was really no one else around. And then all of a sudden, this guy came up just out of the blue and said, you mind if I share your table? And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. I just had that thought. And then he sat down, and then we started talking, and I said, what do you do? And he was doing some kind of quantum theory.
Oh, isn't that something?
He was working for a company that does experiments for credit cards and stuff like that, but they were using like quantum theory.
I can't wait to see quantum
to
theory
do this
versus credit cards.
Encryption.
That's going to be interesting. So here's what the skeptic would say about that. And they've done studies to show that what happens by chance is well beyond chance when you do the numbers and the math. So a skeptic would say, well, every now and then someone's going to go into a restaurant and sit down and go, you don't have a feeling somebody's going to ask to sit with me, which, by the way, is a rare occurrence.
It really
somebody's
is.
Somebody's going to ask to sit with me. And every now and then, out of every million plus opportunity or, you know, thoughts, one thing is going to happen, and that person is going to think it's something, you know, to do with quantum, but it's not. It's just chance. Well, they take the chance. They measure the chance. They do this statistically, and these experiments are showing up well beyond chance. The results are coming in well beyond chance. So it's possible that chance might explain, but the math that's coming in and the results that's coming in are saying these figures are way beyond chance, millions and sometimes more beyond chance.
I agree. I think it is definitely beyond chance, especially you live in Southern California, right? I mean, how often do people really make eye contact? Not often.
No, not often. And the interesting thing that I've found is the more you open yourself up to what you would call coincidence, nicely said as God's way of remaining anonymous, coincidence and serendipity, the more you become aware that those things are actually a part of how life works and connection and the energy that you're actually connecting with and putting out that and you're receiving back, the more you are aware of that, the more it happens. The more you see and these extraordinary things begin showing up and you get this nod from the universe saying, yep, that's right. Keep going. That's right.
Right. And just being open to those messages.
Yeah.
And you'll get some pretty incredible information.
Yeah.
And here's an interesting question here from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Chattanooga.
From Aisha. And I'd like to bring her on to join the conversation. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk to Tom.
Well, here you are with Tom Shadyac.
Hey, Aisha, how far is Chattanooga from Memphis? My family, my brother runs St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. He's the CEO, and I'm in Memphis all the time. How far are you from there?
That's a good 8 hours.
You're on the other side. Okay, Memphis, on the other side of the state. Okay.
Yeah, we're more near Atlanta or Nashville.
Okay, all right, you're the eastern half then.
Yeah, so I just first of all wanted to say thank you for everything that you're doing. I have been obsessed with IAM since I saw the preview, really, and I've just been excited to follow your career and what you're doing. And my question was just about cooperation and what's something that we all can do, just something easy. I mean, you were talking about making eye contact or smiling. You know, what can we do to bring about this shift and this change?
Well, you know, Aisha, thank you, first of all, so much. I really appreciate you. You encourage me. You remind me that that the work does have an effect, and I appreciate it very much. So, look, you've already made a change. You've made a change in me by encouraging me. Now, there's nothing that I can do specifically, no instruction I can give you in the specific to tell you what to do. Mm-hmm. That's up to you. That is up to you. But that thing that's on your heart, you mentioned smiling, maybe waving hello, whatever it is that feels right to you, that one step, that's it. That's the thing. You know, I was just in, I'm considering maybe moving up to Boulder, Colorado, because it's more centrally located and I'm doing a lot of speaking and teaching all over the country. And I noticed what you were saying, that Boulder's becoming a little bit of a city. It's a beautiful place, wonderful. But that people didn't say hello. They didn't kind of wave. They kind of were becoming a little bit of a city. And I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, and this feels to me like this is my little calling. Going to go, hey, how are you? And, you know, just make eye contact. And so that's what spoke to me in that moment. And there are things that speak to you and others all the time. And that's remember, so it doesn't have to be big. You don't have to make a movie like I am, you know. You don't have to put out a New York Times bestseller. It can literally be in that moment when that person asks you, can I sit with you? And you say, that would be great. And then you have a conversation, and you shift his energy, which shifts another energy, and the ripple effect becomes eternal.
Yeah, that's so very true.
What are some things that you have found work that you are that are speaking to you?
Well, what's on my heart recently has just been women. And so sometimes I wake up and I just say, if there's a woman that's in need or there's a woman that's hurting or there's anyone I can help, please put that person in my path. And more times than not, something happens. And it's as literal as seeing someone who's sad. And today I saw a friend and I knew she was hurting and I sent her a special text message, you know, just a little picture to cheer her up. You know, it's just what was on my heart and what I was feeling like needed to be done. So I guess it's just following those little instincts of cooperation and love.
Very, very, very much so. And may I say, may I speak for God here, maybe? So may be so audacious as to speak for God, I believe that God will say to you, that moment when you sent the encouraging text is the same thing as when someone writes a New York Times bestseller, puts out a hit movie, or gives $1 million to charity. It's all the same thing to me,
yeah.
Right? God doesn't see things linearly. He sees the action, and the action is the same. What may get someone to write $1 million check is the same motivation and spirit that gets you to say, I'm going to reach out to another person with a text of love.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thought. And I think if more people looked at it that way, we perhaps would do more of these little things that we sometimes feel are inconsequential.
Yeah, they are not.
Yeah.
They are not. I think when we meet the maker, not that I'm saying that's literally going to happen, you know, and like we get to go over our little lives or you know, I think we're going to tend to go, okay, so I had these hit movies or I had these. You go, no. I want to talk about the powerful stuff. Well, I had the New York Times. No. I want to talk about the time that you texted the person. You don't know how down they were.
Uh-huh.
I want to talk about that. Oh, that just made all the angels sing. You know, I really think it's like that. I do. And people like you who are stepping into this with courage are changing things.
That's such a great point. Have you read Tom's book yet, Aisha?
I have not. I've read bits and pieces online because I know it for a while, and maybe still you could view it for free online. So, I would love to read the whole thing.
I'm going to send you a copy. I think you're really going to like it.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much.
All right.
Thanks, Aisha.
Aisha,
Tom,
cool.
Keep up
peace.
The good work.
Right on. You too.
Thank you.
All right. Peace.
What I like about your philosophy, Tom, it's so great because, you know, being in, and I guess, would you call it the woo-woo world or the mind-body-spirit world? Or
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I've been at Hay House Radio for 8 years, and I've talked to a lot of people. And there's people that say, I know what happens when you die, and you're going to experience this, this, and this, or this is how it's going to be. And, you know, you even say, I think that this might be the way it is, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of like that you leave it open for questioning.
Yeah.
Where... Because really, who really knows, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe they got
until you get there.
That, yeah, I haven't gotten the memo yet. So, but yeah. Thank you. Oftentimes the mind, body, spirit world forgets the body, you know, that we're here, that it's, you know, that we're in these things for a reason, you know? It's not all about just overcoming the flesh. It's not all about that woo-woo, you know, idea. It's not just about wearing white. There are colors here. There are experiences. There are passions. There are pains. It's all a part of the design, and it's all beautiful.
Right. And I think sometimes that there doesn't have to be necessarily a reason for everything, or you didn't bring something on to make something happen, that's part of the human experience, right?
There's so many swirling energies.
Right. I mean, there's all these different variables and things like that. And then just for example, what, you know, we were talking about with Aisha, you know, the one little touch, the one small gesture that you can make will cause a ripple effect. And maybe her friend that she sent the good text to is going to feel better. And then she'll touch another person.
Yeah.
And then that's how it works.
Yeah.
And on and on.
Agreed. Fully agreed.
That's good stuff. So I wanted to talk a little bit, too, just to shift for the last couple minutes here about the education system, because you had some strong opinions in the book about the education system in this country. And there's so much debate about this. And my mother was a teacher her whole life, and my sister's an assistant principal. And so I've heard their frustrations over the years and teaching to the test and all that. And things really need to change. I mean, that whole system is kind of broken down. And I just wanted you to share your opinion on kind of we're forcing kids into these boxes and, you know, you need to study this. And yeah, we should all be educated and that should be offered. But can't things be done a little bit differently?
I hope so.
My high school years weren't that great.
Yeah,
you know, it's got to be better.
I was not a fan of school. It didn't serve my particular light or path. So education comes from the Latin word educato, and it means to draw out. So the truest education is to draw out who you are. Oh, you love to paint. You love horses. You love to dance. You love argument. Maybe might like law or debate, etc. And what we do is we drill in. Okay, kids, here's what you need to know. Stop looking out the window, which is naturally the kid is a perfectly designed learner. And if we would listen to the young man or woman who's looking out the window saying, what are you looking at? I'm looking at the leaves. What is it that you love about the leaves? I love their colors. Do you know what happens? Why they become yellow or green or fall? And you can just lock right into where a child is and teach them everything. And teach the most important thing, which is to draw out who they are. And so since we don't do that, we have an overly medicated society of young people. There's more depression, more suicide, more medication, more drugs. We have diseases upon diseases from ADD, et cetera. And it's because we don't understand that process. We are taking the student and molding them. Mary Oliver's one of my favorite people in the world. She happens to be a friend. She's a great poet. And Mary is a big fan of what you might call proper education, but has seen the poison of present-day education. And she says, Tom, kids walk in so alive, so full of that childlike energy, and by the time they get to high school, the light is gone. We've turned them into the product. That's how she puts it. We've turned them into the product. And that's how education was originally, the schooling system was to create workers for the assembly line production industrial revolution that had taken place. And we've got to understand that the human being is much more spirit-based than just fitting widgets and wedges into machines. And this is why I believe that our culture has school shootings showing up. The rooting of this is that we're literally killing our kids, so our kids are killing each other. We're killing their light, so they're literally killing the light of themselves and others. It's a violent idea that we pit them against each other in this overly competitive place, saying, okay, some of you are going to be winners, some of you are going to go to Harvard, and some of you are going to be losers. The losers might not eat, the winners will eat. That's not the law, that's not in life's operating manual. That is how life does not thrive. And until we understand that we're all for each other and not against each other, and we craft an education system around that idea, this is a larger societal problem. You cannot isolate education. It is an outgrowth of a society that has adopted ideas that are not helping us thrive. It's in our society. It's in our economic structuring. It's how we do business with each other. It's how we see each other, not as brothers and sisters, but as competitors, winners and losers.
Right. Well, especially with the education system and in school, because it's pretty clear cut. You know, if you get an F, you fail. If you don't graduate, you fail.
Right.
You know, you have no worth.
Right.
And that's told to you time and time again. You know,
right.
And there's that fear, you know, well, if I don't get a college degree, I'll never get a good job and I'll never succeed.
Right.
So you have those beliefs already. How can kids even compete?
Well, and I want to make something clear, because the knock on this is, okay, we've created a generation where everybody gets a trophy. This is not about that. If you're excellent, if you're the in school, we could find out that you are going to be an excellent communicator, so maybe radio or television or media was for you. I want to do what I can to help and support you be the most excellent radio host. Go ahead and give you the trophy for radio host and dialogue and excellence. I'm super happy with that. You need to give me a trophy for that. You need to find out what my trophy is. What's Tom's trophy, right? What is he? So let's have the radio competition, and you're number one. You're the best. Let's support you. But now what does Tom do well? Tom maybe is good at one-on-one conversation. He can encourage his neighbors. He can encourage a friend. Well, why is that not a worthy occupation in society? Why is someone who can encourage another, even through just common conversation, why is that not worthy? We put value on certain things, and they live and eat incredibly well, and other things we say, sorry, no good. And that's going to have to stop, because those cells rise up. They say, you're not going to let me eat, then I'm going to take. That's what a criminal is. He's hungry.
Right.
He's hungry because somebody has all the stuff. right?
And it's so unfair, just the way things are stacked.
Well, yeah, the results are actually fair, because when we care about the things that we care about, we get a society that's broken. But it's based on something that doesn't work. It's just based on something that doesn't work. And again, education is just the soul of society as it moves forward. It reflects itself in education. So it's a larger societal issue. But people don't see this right now. This is why I've written this book, and I will write others, and I'm eventually going to do a radio show, too, with Sirius XM called One Big Couch. It's coming up soon in July. July 7th we start. I think it's 3 o'clock L.A. time, 6 o'clock East Coast time. But I want to talk about these very things, because our society simply talks about how do we get more money in education, how do we fix the problem of overcrowding, et cetera, but they don't talk about the root cause of these problems. There have been 74 shootings since Newtown, I believe, just at our school, 74 shootings, and that problem, that rogue cell keeps showing up, and we have yet to find out why it's showing up.
It's crazy. And then, you know, we're supposed to be more cooperative to each other, and that's our natural way, and more loving, but yet these people refuse to give up their guns, and, you know, we feel that we have to barricade ourselves in and protect ourselves from the guy next door. I mean, that's just kind of feeding the problem.
Well, it's just, I see fear, you know. A knife in the hand of a surgeon is an amazing tool. It can heal. A knife in the hand of someone with an ideology that we're all separate and I need to protect me, and I am separate than you, and you're not my family and not my brother, that knife can become very dangerous. So it's the ideology. You know, I'll agree with anyone about guns or knives, that the ideology is what we have to look at. It needs to be looked at. Now, in the short term, I agree, there has to be some reasonable regulations around any of these instruments that can harm, because we're coming out of a poisoned idea. And because we're coming out of a poisoned idea, there's a lot of toxicity out there, and so regulation in this area can only help. But in the long run, the idea needs to be looked at. You could put Jesus in a gun factory, and that gun would never go off. No gun would ever go off, right? So it was because an idea possessed him, that love is the way forward. And until that idea possesses us, love as the basis of the state has never been tried, is another quote from Emerson. And until we move forward with love, then this state is going to continue to have, the state of the world is going to continue to have these violent actions showing up.
And just in the medicating of society, too, that's a whole other problem.
Yeah, well, that's because we don't understand how important it is to feel, right? You know, and we've made sadness bad. We've made things like pain bad. And it's not bad. It's instructive. It's the refiner's fire. It's how everything in nature gets stronger, is going through these things that we medicate ourselves against. The pain is, depression is interesting. It's actually not what I think most people think it is. It's the feelings are depressed. What do you say to someone when they're sad or their tears in their eyes? We say, what's wrong? As if it's wrong to be sad, as opposed to what are you feeling? What's happening? I found out some news about someone who's sick or ill or passed. That's so sad. And we stay in that sadness. We say, what's wrong? And we want to just, come on, don't be sad. We tell our kids very early, don't cry. Like,
right.
No,
they shouldn't feel it, right?
Feel it. It's good. What is that? What is that? Well, let's talk about it. What is it? Yeah, what is it? And what's it there for? And, we're getting there. We're getting there.
Slowly there. But surely. And really, if you think about it, when you look at any kind of great change, has got to come out of someone, you know, feeling something intensely. Because if you look at people, they say they want to change, but only when something really happens to kind of shake them out of whatever stupor they were in, or, you know,
of course,
kind of rolling along.
Of course. I say this with, with a bit of cringing. I have gratitude with attitude, but there has never been a story written where pain has not played a central role. Never been a powerful story written where pain and difficulty have not played a central role. It's the way it is. I say gratitude with attitude because I say, God, could you not have designed it so that jelly donuts would make us grow, so that jelly donuts could start a great story? And then you think about it, and you're like, no, that wouldn't work, would it? And I can't come up with a better way. I understand what it's about, and I cringe when I say it. It's called the awful grace of God, because there is something about that that turns people who are powerless into powerful. And when they go through that diagnosis and they meet it with courage, or they go through that death of anything, a job or even a spouse or a partner, then they move forward with courage, and they create and they invent and they engage and they get involved in community. And the not-for-profit world, which is the most profitable world that we have, and we see that life come alive because of that death. And that's the paradox. Merton said life exists in the belly of a paradox, and that's the paradox.
Right. That's so true. Because only through that will something really happen. Will that spur someone to really make that great change or write that great song? I mean, we wouldn't have all the great rock songs either.
Mary Oliver says it very well. Whoever made music of a mild day? You make music from the storms, from the tumult, from the high winds which are carving the canyons. That's what makes music.
Right. That's so true. So we have just 3 minutes left. This has flown by. There's so many more things I could ask you, but I don't know if I could do it, you know, in just 3 minutes. So I guess what would be kind of some final thoughts? You said you're working on some other books.
Well, the final thought, you know, first of all, I hope they'll tune into our radio show, One Big Couch. It's on Sirius XM 104 if they have that. If not, maybe go on our website.
So will you have guests and
people? Yeah, I'll hopefully do what you're doing. I'm learning from you. I'm in deep admiration for your gift.
Thank you.
Because it's not easy. I've done it a little bit for Sirius. But we want people to jump up on the couch with us. And it's all about self-healing, because to change the world, you know, it starts with changing ourselves. But my final thought, you know, here in the last minute would just be that if everybody could just let go of the judgment of themselves and not should on themselves, it would do a great distance to help heal not only themselves but the world around them. They're exactly where they're supposed to be. And rather than look at it and say, oh, I should be doing this, or I should have done that, or I should keep shooting on yourself, if they could just say, okay, I'm currently doing this, and I feel that it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel like my heart. So that means I need to move into another direction, and it's all good. Everything is working together. There's a saying in the Bible that's very powerful: all things work together for good. It doesn't say some things. It doesn't say many things. It doesn't say just the positive things. It says all things work together for good. And I hope that people can just start to look at themselves as I believe the divine looks at them, like they look at their own children, as absolutely beautiful, perfect, and in process at the same time.
Right, that we really are enough, and we have everything that we need.
Absolutely.
We're all self-contained.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. That's why contentment
little
is,
vessels.
Contentment is a better word, I think, than happiness, because contentment comes from the word content, what's on the inside.
I like that, because it's easier, I think, to shoot for contentment than, I mean, who can be happy all the time?
Well, if we understand what happiness is, you can be, because happiness means that you can be sad. It means that your overall feeling of life is one that has a positive energy, if you will. But that involves the negative. Like you said, the negative spurs on the positive. So happiness is just a term that has come to mean smiling 24/7, and that's not what the true term happiness means.
Right, the light and the dark. So the Big Couch, now when will that debut?
One Big Couch.
One Big Couch.
July 7th, XM 104, Sirius XM 104, 3 o'clock L.A. time, 6 o'clock East Coast time. We're going to do things like this. We'll take calls. We'll try to, like, help people with what they're struggling with, and we'll talk about ideas from education to the way we run our economy to, you know, other
you
other
name
topics.
It. That's so great. I mean, we could have taken a few more calls, but I've got people that want to give you movie ideas, and I don't know if we wanted to talk about that. I wanted to talk about the book, so we didn't
goodness. Do that. No, it's all good. It's all good. Yeah, we'll hold the movie ideas. Thank you, though.
Well, thank you so much, Tom Chadiak, and best of luck. I'll be listening for your new show, and keeping an eye out for some new books coming soon.
Thanks, Diane. Much love to you. Appreciate it.